You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO at 102.7 FM.
It's a whimsical road trip story, and it's about cars, but the two authors aren't traveling by car. They crisscross the U.S. by Greyhound and walk the cities on foot. From that perspective, they reflect upon the automobile and how central it is to shaping the culture, the health, the economy, and the physical environment. The result is a fact-rich handbook and a veritable guide to the world of Homo Automobitis. Stop Signs, Cars and Capitalism is the title of a new book co-authored by Bianca Mugeni and Eve Engler. Eve is familiar to Red Eye listeners for his earlier books on Canadian foreign policy from Haiti to Palestine. And he joins me by phone from near the bus station in Iowa City, and he's in the midst of a book tour that will bring him to Vancouver later this month. Good morning, Eve.
Hey.
Good morning. How are you?
Good.
Great. And we usually refer to our species as Homo sapiens, flattering ourselves as thinking beings. So you refer to it as creatures of the car, or Homo automobitis. What's the significance of that reframing?
Well, it's I think that from an evolutionary biologist perspective, looking back a couple hundred years from now, they might look at the North American landscape and postulate the rise of such a species. And basically, it's the whole geographical, cultural, economic process that comes along with the rise of the private automobile, where it makes us willing to drive the most or get around in the most dangerous form of transportation. It makes us feel that if we park a block away from where we have to go, it's a defeat, and that walking that extra block is some sort of danger, and it's a state where it's seen as reasonable to travel 40, 50 kilometers every day to and from a workplace. So it's somewhat of a gimmick, I guess, of the book, but it's it does speak to just how dominant car culture is. The car is in economic, culturally, politically in our lives.
Now, I understand that in the your chapter on your visit to Atlantic City, your reflections focus on the surprising amount of space that cars require when they're parked, when they're moving, when they're being transported around, and how that significantly reshapes our landscape. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, well, first of all, the average automobile is parked 23 hours of the day, so about 95% of the time it's parked, which is exceedingly inefficient. There's varying estimates of how much of a city landscape is devoted to the private to parking and roadway for the private automobile, and in the most extreme North American cities, it's up towards 50%. Of the landscape that's actually devoted to the car. And the more what are considered the more compact or less car dependent places, it still gets up towards a third of the landscape, and that destroys livability. That makes it very difficult for non-drivers to be able to get around without having a vehicle. And ultimately, I think it's an incredible waste of land, of space that would be better devoted to everything from social housing or cooperative housing to park space to corner stores or local restaurants even. And the amount of subsidy that is devoted to off-street parking, basically the estimates say that as much in the U.S., at least 99% of parking is free parking. People park free 99% of the time. Probably in a city like Vancouver, it might be a little bit less than that, but still you're talking about 90% or more. And all the parking space that, if you go park at a Safeway and you park for free, or you go park at a 7-Eleven, you park for free, or you go park at a whatever different shop, all the money put into that parking is being subsidized by somewhere, usually in prices. So the non-driver, when you know going to you know get a go to 7-Eleven to get a Slurpee on a nice warm summer day, they're you know effectively paying a little bit more because of the free parking that's being given out, and ironically, the private automobile is heavily associated with sort of capitalist principles. Yet the driver expects to park free almost all the time. So that's somewhat a part of the contradiction of the ideology. But really, the parking is actually fascinating when you devote look into the question of parking and the fact that. That zoning regulations mandate a certain number of parking spots for each apartment or condo built, right? So it's you know the one author Donald Shoup, this parking guru, talks about how parking requirements and zoning regulations actually exacerbate the homeless crisis because they drive up the price of building housing by mandating a certain number of parking spots. So it's actually quite a fascinating topic that is very rarely discussed, the question of parking.
It's interesting because so much about what you're talking about here, so much about cars are things that we so kind of take for granted because we do have a car culture that it's really invisible to us. And I know that your co-author Bianca Mugeni visits Chicago on her own, and her chapter on Chicago focuses on cars and deaths, including her memory of driving in Africa, and that whole idea of cars and death has almost become invisible to us, even though the numbers are you know kind of skyrocket.
Yeah, we make a societal choice to have about 4,000 people die every year in car crashes in Canada, right? That's a societal choice. That driving is dozens of times more likely to cause death and injury than other forms of transportation. When pedestrians bump into each other, that's usually seen as a positive thing. It's not seen as a reason to, you know, call the insurance or call the ambulance or call the cops. There are very... The danger to cyclists is not other cyclists. I mean, to, you know, to a certain extent, but very limited. It's car drivers, the train systems. You know, it's not just a question of speed. The bullet train in Japan there, since it's been around since 1968, has never had a fatality, right? So it's a societal choice that we make by structuring our cities, our landscape to maximize car use. We're basically saying it's okay to have. A few thousand people die every year, and you know tens of thousands more who are maimed or seriously injured, and you know you go right down into the level of how it's reported in the media. It's just a sort of little blip, you know, holding up traffic. That's what you know somebody who's just lost their lives or a family who's just lost a parent and the kids and no longer have parents. It's just a little you know holding up of traffic. It's not seen as some sort of societal issue that needs to get to the bottom of. Unlike you know when you see train crashes or plane crashes, there's way more of a focus on we got to get to the bottom of what happened here. But I think it's just the extent to which the private car dominates our political landscape, our cultural landscape. It just that we don't even question this choice we've made as a society that we're going to accept thousands of people dying from transport, unnecessary transport related death and injury.
Now, a lot of your chapters are structured around particular cities, and Salt Lake City, of course, is the sort of iconic city of worship, the sacred city for Mormons. What did you have to say about worship of the car?
Well, the first thing is that anyone who was to look at Salt Lake City from maybe from another planet would think that people in Salt Lake City are not worshiping the Mormon Church, but are rather worshiping the car. The amount of landscape that's devoted to the church is negligible compared to the amount of space devoted to the private car, and we use that chapter as a jumping off point to discuss sort of the religion of the automobile, if you like, and just the extent to which it's what you can do in an automobile, everything from getting married in a drive-through to even strip clubs and drive-through strip clubs these days, supposedly in Pittsburgh area, to paying you know, taxes or returning library books, or the list is endless. And just the extent of the cultural, the songs, the amount of songs that are devoted to the private automobile. The, you know, I don't think it's still going on in Vancouver, but the, you know, the races, you know, Montreal, the F1 Formula One race. It's just incredible, the tens and hundreds of thousands of people that descend on Montreal to worship the private automobile. And really, it's a worship. It's, I think, particularly strong among the male of our species. But really is, I remember that going to at VanTech in grade 9 or 10, I did a shop class, auto shop class, and just the extent to which the other boys in the class were knowledgeable about the car and fixated on it. It was amazing. These are people who weren't even old enough to drive yet, and had already fully got caught into this culture, which I guess for most boys, it's, you know, the age of 3 or 4 or 5. I don't know when it is exactly, but they start already sort of to identify, you know, manhood and the whatever with the private automobile. So it's that's one of the our obstacles to moving away from the private automobile. It's not our main obstacle to moving away from the private automobile, but it is nevertheless the fact that that culture has seeped down into so many people's identity is a real hindrance to moving towards a more socially, environmentally sustainable form of transportation.
Now, the book's called Stop Signs, Cars, and Capitalism, and you're exploring this kind of inseparable connection between cars and capitalism. How central is the manufacturing of cars to capitalism?
It's been a big part. The private automobile it's been a number one source of corporate profit for the past century. It underpins a lot of corporate power. But it's the manufacturing of the automobile is a big component of that, but it's only a sliver of the overall. You have what we term in the book the auto gang, so the banks that do hundreds of billions of dollars in car loans every year, the insurance and the car insurance industry, the asphalt companies, the auto scrap yards, obviously the oil industry, which is they all benefit from and support car infrastructure and the expansion of the private automobile. But then if you go even further, you look at all the big box retailers. There is no Walmart without the private automobile, right? For a whole series of reasons, the quantity of good. When we were in El Paso, Texas, and we entered a Walmart where we saw a 5-pound apple pie. And we, realize that you don't buy a 5-pound apple pie if you walk in that home, right? You only do that if you're going to put it into a vehicle, preferably a large vehicle. So the whole basis of how Walmart is structured, both in delivery phase with the just-in-time delivery and to actual consumers, is structured around the private automobile. Going further, so the same thing with fast food restaurants, and there's a whole series of reasons why fast food industries, the chain restaurants are based around the private automobile. That's really where they come out of, and the landscape is much more conducive than in a more urban area. And so it's very difficult for a family-run restaurant to open up shop on the exurbs of a city for a whole series of reasons, but also the growth in house sizes, right? The house sizes have increased, doubled since the 1950s. Well, that's all underpinned by the private automobile. Well, the growth in house sizes, of course, very good for the resources that go into building houses, the wood, the cement, etc. And moreover, you go further with that, the whole growth of the appliance industry. There's you don't have six TVs, 3 fridges, 8 couches if you have an apartment. If you have a 4,000-foot McMansion, you might, right? So basically the private automobile, both directly in terms of the automakers and the auto gang that are directly benefiting from it, but also indirectly in the whole huge sector of the corporate world, is just a perfect vehicle for endless consumption, for constant profit making, and at the crux, there's some other reasons, some ideological reasons, but at the crux, that is the reason for the rise of the private automobile and its overwhelming dominance in our landscape today.
Now, your book ends, Eve, with ideas to strengthen the anti-car movement. Is that one of the goals of your current book tour?
For sure. I mean, for sure. I think that, we were in Boston with a group, Bikes Not Bombs, in Boston, and one of the people who brought us in there said there was a debate within that organization over a T-shirt that said that they'd been printing that said one less car. And people said, oh, that's too negative, and no, we should just produce a shirt that says one more bike. Well, what does one more bike mean? That means somebody who has an SUV who takes the bike out to the weekend to go up the mountain? That's something we want to promote? No, of course not. We want to be being explicit that we have to move beyond the private automobile as the way that we structure mass transportation. And I mean that like completely. The whole social relations that have come about with the private automobile, we need to simply move beyond that. It's not something that can happen overnight, of course. It's something that needs to take place with a whole series of reforms. But we simply can't continue a situation where individuals hop into 2, 4, or 8,000-pound metal boxes to get around. And so one of the things what we want to do with this book, obviously, with every book you want to reach as wide an audience as possible, but realistically, one of the things that we want to do with this book is to strengthen the position or whatever of people within the bicycling groups within that are pushing for more mass transit to also add to strengthen them in terms of being more explicitly critical of the private automobile. And that's not an easy fight. That's something that comes up against a lot of resistance. But I think it is ultimately something that is both necessary from an ecological standpoint, but additionally is something that will lead to better landscape, a place where people are healthier because they get more exercise, where they don't suck in as many pollutants, where communities have a greater interaction. So it's something. This move against beyond the private automobile is something that needs to happen for ecological reasons. But there's I think ultimately it's going to be better for all of us.
Well, it's been really good talking to you this morning, Eve, and I'll look forward to your talk in Vancouver at the end of the month.
Thanks for having me.
I've been speaking with Eve Engler. He's a co-author with Bianca Mugeni of the new book, Stop Signs, Cars, and Capitalism. And Eve will be speaking in Vancouver on Monday, June 27th at 7 p.m. in room 1700 at Simon Fraser University Harbor Center campus. And he'll be joined by Vancouver City Councillor David Cadman.